This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, January 21, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. President Bush gives what many hope will be his last annual State of the Union address. The US military quietly announces a global reassessment of its force deployment, saying it's developed a places, not bases, military philosophy. We look at why Russians are concerned about US military bases. And in the second part of our special series examining the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender communities, today we go to Argentina. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. George Bush's State of the Union speech was watched around the world. Many in Arab nations were displeased by much of what they heard. Ula Al-Farawati reports from Amman.
President Bush's State of the Union address was received angrily in the Arab world. Politicians and the public alike criticized what the president termed as a legitimate war on Iraq. Many here also lashed out at President Bush for a complete ignorance of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Saeed Diab is Secretary General of the Jordanian left-wing Arab Democratic Unity Party.
We are sorry to hear this. What we heard emphasizes that the Bush administration was not serious when they presented the Middle East peace roadmap. This tells us that the American administration is not serious in solving the Arab problems.
In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati.
We'll have more analysis on the State of the Union coming up. There's much uncertainty around how and when the United Nations will lead Iraq towards the next political step. From the UN, Heather Risby reports.
A United Nations team is ready to go to Iraq to assess the conditions for elections, but no date has been fixed as yet. On Monday, United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan met members of the Iraqi Governing Council and U.S. Administrator in Iraq. After the meeting, Annan backed the U.S. view that June 30th is not a practical date for holding elections in Iraq. Observers say sending a UN team to Iraq is one of the ways to pacify Shia leader Ayatollah Sistani, who is demanding direct elections within the next 5 months. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
The International Criminal Court received papers asking for an investigation of Prime Minister Tony Blair for war crimes. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
A report alleging illegal deployment of depleted uranium cluster bombs and weapons in civilian areas was handed to the court's chief prosecutor in The Hague yesterday. He'll now decide whether to begin a formal investigation into unnecessary and unjustified civilian casualties. Such an investigation seems unlikely, but the court has not ruled it out. No case can be made against the US administration because the US has not signed the treaty that established the court. This is Naomi Fowler in London.
Amnesty International is requesting Swiss officials uphold human rights practices during the World Economic Forum and planned counter-protests during the event. During today's peaceful political ballet, police surrounded 50 people and arrested 10. Diletta Varlese reports from Zurich.
The members and participants are the 1,000 richest companies of the world. This year, in the small city of Davos, 2,100 delegates are expected from 94 different countries. U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney will speak to the group on Saturday. Protest mobilization already started on Saturday in Lugano, Switzerland, and other cities around the country. Today in Zurich, actions have been organized by the Anti-WTO Coordination Switzerland to deny delegates transport from Zurich Airport to Davos. The police present and military forces are expected to be 10,000 strong, ready to use tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse any protesters. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Diletta Varlese from the Switzerland Indy Media Center in Zurich.
Human rights activists were anxiously waiting for the arrest of a former army colonel and intelligence chief after Guatemala's Supreme Court this week sentenced him to 30 years in prison. Catherine Elton has more from Guatemala City.
Nearly 14 years after anthropologist Myrna Mack was stabbed 27 times on a Guatemala City street, the Supreme Court ruled Monday that Colonel Juan Valencia masterminded the murder. Valencia was originally found guilty of the crime in a 2002 trial, but an appeals court overturned the verdict last May. Prosecutors argued that Valencia ordered Mac's murder because of her politically sensitive research on the Maya Indians who became refugees during Guatemala's civil war. The decades-long war ended in 1996. Valencia served as a director within the Presidential Guard, an entity long signaled as the focal point for wartime repression and rights violations. For FSRN, I'm Catherine Elton in Guatemala City.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Last night, President George Bush gave his last State of the Union address for his four-year term. In his address to Congress, Bush stated his support for a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. He proposed making his faith-based initiatives permanent, increasing funds for drug testing in schools, and starting a campaign to combat sexually transmitted diseases through abstinence. Bush also proposed reauthorizing the two previous years' tax cuts and the Patriot Act before provisions in those measures expire. While Bush defended the invasion of Iraq, he made no mention of last year's dubious assertions of Iraq trying to buy uranium from Africa, or that Saddam Hussein was close to unleashing weapons of mass destruction on the US and its allies. Our correspondent Mitch Jeserich was at Capitol Hill last night, and he brings us this report.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
Let us be candid about the consequences of leaving Saddam Hussein in power. We're seeking all the facts. Already, the Kay Report identified dozens of weapons of mass destruction-related program activities and significant amounts of equipment that Iraq concealed from the United Nations. Had we failed to act, the dictator's weapons of mass destruction programs would continue to this day.
In a State of the Union address, President Bush defended the invasion of Iraq by saying CIA weapons inspector David Kaye's preliminary report suggested Iraq had programs meant to develop weapons of mass destruction. However, what Bush failed to add, besides that the weapons themselves have not been found, was that Kaye, who has stopped looking for the weapons himself, indicated that the so-called programs haven't been touched in years. Since the occupation of Iraq began, the U.S. intelligence community has been under scrutiny for its dubious information on pre-war Iraq. The Senate Intelligence Committee is investigating the CIA over the information failure. After the State of the Union address, FSRN asked Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, who serves on the Senate Intelligence Committee, about the prospects of the investigation, including high-level administration officials.
Well, unfortunately, the Republican leadership in the Senate Intelligence Committee will not allow us to investigate whether the intelligence data was misused by any member of the administration. And as a result, I don't think any investigation we ever submit is going to be complete or credible.
President Bush spent a good first half of his address defending his war on terrorism. He used the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center as an example of why his administration has denied suspected terrorists their day in court.
After the World Trade Center was first attacked in 1993, some of the guilty were indicted and tried and convicted and sent to prison. But the matter was not settled. The terrorists were still training and plotting in other nations and drawing up more ambitious plans. After the chaos and carnage of September the 11th, it is not enough to serve our enemies with legal papers.
It makes me think about some real fundamental tenets of the democracy. Things like separation of powers, the kinds of things that are really the firmament of American democracy, the thing that makes sure that we don't get off track.
Elisa Massiminos with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, citing the Patriot Act and the treatment of detainees, says the State of the Union is out of balance because the Bush administration is putting itself above the law.
Provisions of the Patriot Act are set to expire next year. You need to renew the Patriot Act.
To say provisions of the Patriot Act expire next year is a bit misleading, considering they expire on December 31, 2005, which is closer to 2 years away. Patriot Act provisions set to expire include permitting police to conduct internet surveillance without a warrant, allowing police to share contents of wiretaps with the CIA and other agencies, and allowing the FBI to look at library records. Senate Majority Republican Leader Bill Frist talked with FSRN after Bush's address.
I support the president wholeheartedly. We will be reauthorizing the Patriot Act sometime over the course of the next year.
Though the Republicans control Congress, it may prove difficult to reauthorize the Patriot Act, as even some Republicans have reservations over the hastily passed law. Republican Senator Arlen Specter is a high-ranking member on the Senate Judicial Committee who likes and dislikes parts of the act.
If you have probable cause to think that a crime has been committed and there's also an overlap on security and intelligence, I think it made sense to utilize it once you found the evidence. So when it comes to the issue of detention, though, I think there has to be a reason on an individualized basis. So the Patriot Act, I think, has been important, but I don't believe you ought to handle it in a blanket generalization.
I'm Mitch Jezerich on Capitol Hill for Free Speech Radio News.
Though President Bush has attended dozens of fundraisers for his re-election campaign since the invasion of Iraq began, he has yet to attend a single funeral for any of the more than 500 U.S. military personnel that have died during the war and occupation of Iraq. During the State of the Union address last night, military family members and peace activists held a vigil outside the Capitol for all the people who've died in the war. Jenny Johnson from our D.C. Bureau brings us this sound collage.
Sergeant Kendall Waters Bay, 29, U.S. Marine Corps.
Farrell Shane Childers, 30, U.S. Marines.
Valentina Bashar Faraj, and I stand for 200 Iraqi civilians killed.
The president lied to us last year in the State of the Union, and it wasn't just those 16 words. It was a lot more. So we feel that the president is going to lie to us again tonight. We're here to mourn not only the U.S. soldiers who have died, but also the innocent civilians who have died in this illegal and unjust war.
Okay, what you're seeing here, the little number is the number of the order of death. So the 169, 171 is the order of death. That's how you're lining up.
I'm Doug Nelson. I'm a Vietnam vet. We were lied to as well. It's going to take us a while to wake up.
There is growing outrage in Australia over U.S. moves to station military bases and troops on Australian soil. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Richard Myers is currently visiting Australia, where he's laying the groundwork for what he says is not a military base, but a joint military training facility in northern Australia, which will pre-position equipment and material in case of war. Myers told the Australian press that in its global reassessment of its force deployment, the US has developed a places, not bases, doctrine under which it will store large amounts of equipment from tanks to aircraft and fuel and ammunition around the world to allow the rapid deployment of troops into US war fields. Meanwhile, debate is also raging in Russia over US military moves closer to its border. Russian military expert Ruslan Puchow, speaking on Polish radio in Warsaw, claimed that the location of an American military base in Poland will influence the Polish-Russian relations in a very negative way. Danuta Szafran-Yetz reports from Warsaw.
The United States has hinted that it has been looking for a new home for its troops, currently stationed in Germany, at least since last spring. To make up for lost international support after invading Iraq, the U.S. has relied on political support from former communist countries in Central and Eastern Europe, traditionally strong allies of the United States. Moving U.S. bases from Germany to Poland has been seen by some as a way of punishing Germany for their opposition to the war in Iraq. On the other hand, Russians have been voicing their doubts about U.S. bases closer to their border. The Bush administration says that any redeployment of troops to Eastern Europe is intended to tackle new security threats and is in no way directed against Moscow. But harsh words came from Russia just days after Poland launched negotiations with Washington on hosting U.S. military bases on its territory. Russian military expert Ruslan Puchow for the first time admitted the Russian discontent so openly.
I have no doubt that the relocation of American bases to Poland will negatively influence relations between our countries, and it will because the Russian authorities and President Putin in particular will read it as a personal failure. That's why Russia will definitely seek an adequate answer to that situation.
Poland, described as the United States' staunchest ally in Europe, even risks its reputation on the eve of becoming an EU member when it backed the US in an argument with France and Germany over Iraq. However, Puhov in the same interview simultaneously expressed the opinion that Russia would not use its nuclear weapons as a toy gun against Poland.
I think there is no such danger, and even if it did appear, it would be beneficial to Poland because the country could receive more help from both Washington and Brussels. For example, for tightening its borders. Such a danger is convenient for Poles, and I find it unlikely that the Russians would do something convenient for Poles.
Puhov's words were received by Polish military experts and officials as a threat that shouldn't be treated seriously. Janusz Onyszkiewicz, former Poland defense minister.
This is nothing serious. First of all, in accordance with declarations of both sides, all strategic missiles are targeted somewhere in the Pacific. Secondly, taking into consideration the fact that the potential American base in Poland would be small, it is unlikely that it would be worth any hassle for the Russian side, even in case of the worst scenario.
Speaking recently about the possible base relocation, Defense Minister Jerzy Szmajdziński declined to give any detail on the upcoming round of talks on the issue. Meanwhile, Poland and the US have stepped up military ties since the US invasion of Iraq. There are currently 2,400 Polish troops serving there. Wojciech Buczak, expert from Raport Military Magazine, perceives the issue as of political rather than military importance.
That sort of the declarations which were issued by some anonymous politicians in Moscow, I would take as a sign of the international fighting in Kremlin for the political uses of that fact. The fact that Poland is eager and Americans are also willing to locate something like a military base or the military installation in Poland.
Under former President Boris Yeltsin, Russia strongly opposed NATO's move to incorporate past Soviet allies from Eastern and Central Europe, but President Vladimir Putin softened Moscow's opposition after signing a partnership agreement with NATO in May 2002. Russia's relations with the US and NATO flourished thanks to Putin's steadfast support for the US-led war in Afghanistan, but Moscow warned both Washington and NATO against deploying weapons closer to Russian borders. Date of deployment of US troops in Poland has yet to be decided, but it is certain that this will be one of the main topics of talks between President Bush and Alexander Kwaśniewski during their meeting in the White House on January 26. In Warsaw, I'm Danuta Szafraniec for Free Speech Radio News.
Vietnam reported today that it has bridged its trade deficit, bringing the figure down by 120 million from the same time last year to 170 million, one of the lowest trade deficits in Asia. One of the reasons for the reduced deficit is the country's booming garment export sector, which is growing at a rate of 20% each year. Garment exports, second only to crude oil, is expected to earn more than $3.5 billion this year, with goods headed to the United States, Europe, and other Asian countries. The sector is employing a growing number of Vietnamese who are leaving farms for factories, as Ngoc Nguyen reports from Hanoi.
The road to Hung Yen is lined with an odd mixture of ancestral graveyards and steel and concrete factories. The province, about 30 miles south of Hanoi, is one of dozens of industrial and export zones throughout the country set up by the government to encourage the influx of foreign capital and companies that sends goods overseas. Pham Chen Hung is 23 years old. He works for a motorcycle parts manufacturer in Hung Yen and earns about $50 a month. He sends about a quarter of that home to his family. He also rents a single room that he shares with three other migrant workers.
Even though wages are too low, I think the growing number of companies is good because it brings jobs and the chance to make a living. The monthly salary may be small for us, but for farmers in the countryside, it's a lot of money. They can support their family on that amount.
At noon, the ghost town feel of the factory lots disappears. Factory doors open wide, and an army of young girls wearing security badges around their necks pour out of the buildings. The street in front of one shoe factory bustles with street vendors selling noodle soup and snacks. 19-year-old Doi packages shoes and boxes them up. She lives in a village about 50 kilometers away, but shares a room with other migrant workers closer to the factory. She says she doesn't like her job, but it's allowed her to get out of her village and earn about $40 a month.
I used to live at home and do housework,
and help my parents plant rice or potatoes. But coming to work in a company, I can support myself and I don't have to do housework.
Bui works about 12 hours a day. She says the work is very tiring because, aside from an hour for lunch, she gets no time for breaks. Two young women in Hanoi sing a farewell song about travelers parting on the road. Doi says lots of girls from her village are moving away from home to work in factories. Every other weekend, when she's not working, she takes the bus or bicycles home to visit her family. Hung makes a trek home too, but he doesn't see his parents at home. His father sharpens knives, and his mother carries baskets of vegetables to sell in Hanoi, where they can make twice as much as their son. Hung says he has friends who have gotten injured on the job. One friend got his finger cut off while operating machinery. Even though the company doesn't offer benefits, it paid for half of the injured worker's hospital bills. Hung says in that department, for every 5 men, 4 are missing at least one finger. Hung says the workers in his factory have no union representation, but they have had several job actions to protest low wages, which he says have made little difference.
The workers in one department would protest by refusing to work. They'd show up but stand outside the gate. Each department would rotate the work stoppage every month. The employers say they will raise wages. They promise to do that every month, but their promises seem to blow away with the wind.
Hong Hae-won runs a Seoul-based business that helps South Korean companies set up shop in Vietnam. He says Vietnamese workers get paid 10 times less than Korean ones. The goods eventually end up back in Korea, though.
They are made a product there, and then they import here in Korea again. And then sometimes the Korean invested company made a product, and they sell another third country like American, Japan, and European country.
Hanoi estimates the number of foreign invested projects or companies in the area will nearly double in the next 15 years, bringing in about $30 billion. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nguyen Nguyen in Hanoi.
Yesterday was the day slated as the last day for many retail candy workers with Fannie Mae in Chicago as plants shut down. While the Service Employees International Union, or the SEIU Local 1, is in negotiation to ensure the workers' pay and benefits, SEIU Local 36 in Philadelphia is waiting for election results from an election that's been long overdue. Dante Toza reports from Philadelphia.
In a battle over local union control, the Service Employee International Local 36 in Philadelphia had an unprecedented turnout to end the trusteeship imposed by the international union. Over 1,000 members of the union voted. Dennis Everingham won the presidency of the Local 36 by a 20% margin. Now the results of the election are being challenged by the losing candidate, Wyatt Kloss, the trustee from the international. Kloss is trying to rerun the election. Election officer Henry Murray explains.
Candidates had an opportunity to file post-election protests, alleging improprieties, which would require investigation. Some candidates did that, and I'm in the process of investigating.
President-elect Dennis Everingham.
There are a number of avenues open to people who win elections if, you know, they're stopped from taking office, and there are two. One is an appeal to the Department of Labor, and the other is going into federal court. I haven't made any decisions at this point about which of those avenues I would choose, because I'm very hopeful that the election officer is going to find that it was a clear margin of victory.
Wyatt Kloss declined an interview with FSRN. Trusteeship is imposed by the international body of the union when there's an internal dispute in the local union. Local 36 has been under trusteeship since June 2002, after a dispute over the presidency of the local. According to the 1959's Landrum-Griffin Act, the trustee cannot hold a local office for more than 18 months, and this past Christmas Eve marked the ending of the legal stay of trustee Wyatt Kloss. In San Francisco, SEIU 87 broke away from SEIU International because they face similar obstruction to union democracy. Despite members' protests, SEIU International tried to merge Local 87 into another union. Union member Edward Mercado explains how Local 36 has changed since the trusteeship began.
Union is protection. Protections for harassments. You could do with members and rally, it's very, very important that our voices be spoken. And back then we had that.
Dilbert Franklin, who has been in the union for 10 years, agrees.
We have some pretty good benefits. I mean, we can go into a hospital or we can get a prescription that would cost us only like maybe 50 cents, 60 cents. Nowhere in the country that you're going to get some benefits like that. And it was, and it's evident for janitors and people to have. Well, when Wyatt and them came in, all that stopped.
Election officer Henry Murray describes the next step in the process.
At some point, when I finish the investigation and issue a decision, I'll be in a position to then go ahead and certify the election if you know, there's no basis for any of the protests.
Murray also says he hopes to finish the investigation by the end of January. Meanwhile, Local 36 is still under the control of SEIU International trustee Wyatt Kloss. For Free Speech Radio News from Philadelphia, this is Dante Toza with Radio Volta.
Buenos Aires is the first Latin American city to recognize the civil union among people of the same or different sex. 2 weeks ago, the nation's Chamber of Representatives included the sexual orientation and identity of gender into the Anti-Discrimination Act. Many applaud Argentine President Néstor Kirchner for welcoming the LGBT community for the first time in history. However, in part two of our special series looking at the worldwide assaults on the rights of LGBT communities, as Miguel Lara reports from Buenos Aires, the issue has opened a fierce debate among human rights activists, the Catholic Church, and traditional political parties.
Buenos Aires is the second largest city in Latin America. Since 1996, the new city constitution includes the right to employment, access to healthcare and educational institutions, regardless of one's sexual preference. It was in that context that the Civil Union Act was passed last year. Marcelo Sundheim, the first man legally united with his male partner, explains why he thinks Buenos Aires was ready to pass the act.
Puntualmente en la Argentina,
the fall of former President de la Rúa, the socioeconomic situation in the Argentina that is alarming.
According to a recent poll from the Women's Social and Political Institute, most of the young people believe lesbians and gays should have the same rights as heterosexuals. Cesar Sigluti is Sundheim's partner and president of the Argentina Homosexual Community, the oldest organization defending gay rights in Argentina.
El tema generacional.
The generational trends mark a very important turning point. If younger people support us, everything will be for the better.
The civil union ceremony was attended by Cesar's parents, showing a non-traditional family picture. Cesar's father, Ismael Sigluti, is 77 years old and a retired military official.
Los de afuera no me interesan.
I'm not worried about anyone outside my home. My primary interest is my family. My children interest me. The Pope said that homosexuals have no family. For God's sake, we are a family.
In April, Argentina's Congress will discuss the National Civil Union Act. It will include three more demands: inheritance, pension after death, and adoption. Yet, according to Maria Jose Libertino, a national deputy, the political setting is complex.
El actor político al que hay que convencer es el justicialismo.
The Justicialist Party is the group that needs to be persuaded because it makes up a majority of the Congress. But the Catholic Church is the main group in opposition to the same-sex civil union, where the Church maintains a lot of commitment with the most conservative economic sectors as it maintained in the past with dictators.
Next month, there will be petitions for a new law on sexual education that will include different sexual preferences in the content taught in all Argentina high schools. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miguel Lara from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can go to our website for an archive of the newscast, www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.